Support for Amplified Voices comes from the Restorative Action Foundation. Learn more at restorativeactionalliance.org.
Everyone has a voice, a story to tell. Some are marginalized and muted. What if there were a way to amplify those stories? To have conversations with real people in real communities? A way to help them step into the power of their lived experience? Welcome to Amplified Voices, a podcast lifting the experiences of people and families impacted by the criminal legal system. Together, we can create positive change for everyone.
Hello and welcome to Amplified Voices. I'm Jason and I'm here today with my co-host Amber. Good morning, Amber.
Good morning, Jason.
Today we are joined by Jean. Jean is in California and she is the mother of a child sexual abuse survivor. And welcome, Jean.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jean, we're going to really give you an opportunity to tell your story and how you got involved in the criminal justice system and what's happened in your family. Thank you so much for being here. Can you tell us, before we get into it, a little bit about you, what your life was like before everything happened and you got involved in the system?
Yeah, so I live in a rural area, very conservative area in California, definitely very red. I was one who believed in law and order, given the harshest punishment. Once an offender, always an offender. I remember when Megan's Law came out, I was thrilled to be able to find out who were the perverts that were living in my neighborhood, so that way I can make sure that my kids stayed away from those areas. When I purchased my first home, my first response was to go look on the registry to find out where all the perverts were in that neighborhood to make sure that I lived away from them. Shortly after I purchased my first home, there was a ballot initiative called Jessica's Law that would prohibit someone on the registry from living anywhere near a park or school. And I'm like, well, yeah, I'm going to vote for that. I've got a park on one side and a school on another. I'm going to protect my kids. I made sure that my kids didn't go to the park alone. You know, they always had to have an adult with them. I made sure that if they were riding their bikes around the neighborhood, they always had to be within view sight, because the last thing I wanted was someone to snatch one of my kids from me and hurt them. And I was doing everything that I was told by the media and our politicians on ways that I could protect my children. And I had the shock of my life about 8 years ago when my teenage daughter came out and told me that she was being sexually abused by someone that we knew. And in that instant, my whole world just turned upside down. I didn't understand how in the world this could happen. You know, what? No, that can't be. But the more she was telling me what was going on, the more I knew she was telling me the truth. I was just in a complete, utter shock and disbelief, but also at the same time, knowing that what she was saying was 100% true. You don't want to believe it, but you know it's true. And I started to blame myself. I started thinking that I must have been a horrible parent because I didn't see it. I didn't see the warning signs. I didn't see the grooming behavior. I didn't see the abuse. And it wasn't until that she shared what was going on that I could look back and I could see all those red lights, all those trigger lights that should have alerted me that something was going on. And that led me to doing research. Well, if it weren't the people on the registry that I should fear, what is the truth? And I went out and I was just searching for data. What is the truth? Because I felt lied to for so long.
So what you're saying is that the person that you trusted was somebody that had never gotten into trouble before with somebody that you didn't suspect? You were busy worrying about the guy that might come to the park or might be lurking in the park, but not this trusted individual.
Oh, absolutely. This person wasn't on the registry. They didn't have a criminal background. And definitely someone in a position of trust, to someone that I didn't have a problem with being around my children. And so I was trying to search and trying to find out what is the truth. You know, who is the threat? Was this just a one-off, or is this the truth, that people not on the registry are the ones that are the biggest threat? And that's what I found when I did my research, is that over 90%, some say up to 95% of sexual abuse is committed by people who are not on the registry and are those who are trusted and known by the victim. And then when I dug in even deeper to find out...
Is that something that you did right away, or is that part of an evolution? I mean, I can imagine being a parent and finding this out must have been... I can almost imagine going into shock and being incapacitated for a while and just even breaking down. I mean, I've heard stories of people just breaking down. Was that your experience, or did you immediately go into, I've got to research this and find out what's going on?
Both. I completely shut down. I was not able to function at all, to the point that my parents would have to come over and tell me, I have to do dishes. I need to vacuum the floor. You know, just the simple everyday tasks that you don't have a problem with before, and you're just sitting there almost zombie-like.
And you have more than one child. So this is affecting both the one that came forward with the abuse, as well as your other children, your whole family.
Correct. And it has such a huge, I mean, it impacted everyone in my family. You know, to my brothers and sisters and parents and in-laws, and it impacted everyone dramatically, and everyone was in a state of shock.
And I think you're a religious person, right?
Very religious. I've been a Christian as far as I can remember. I've been in the church my entire life and gave my life to Christ when I was still very small.
Did your faith help you, or did you end up challenging your faith? Tell us about that.
It definitely strengthened my faith, drew me closer to God, because I couldn't do this on my own. My strength was not enough to be able to handle this. And so I did turn around and I did reach out to my church and try to get help and support in that manner. But unfortunately, the church that I was attending at that time, when they found out that I was not looking for harsh punishment, that I was actually
following the teachings that you were brought up to believe.
Yeah, that I actually had empathy. I actually had forgiveness. I didn't want harsh punishment, because that's not what our daughter wanted. You know, she just wanted that person to get the help and support that they needed, so that way they would no longer offend. She wanted what most victims want, is ownership and accountability and getting the help that they needed. And so that's what we were pushing for. But the church that I attended thought I was crazy and told me that God wouldn't want that. And so I actually had to leave that church, because I could no longer attend a church that did not practice what it preached. It's okay for everybody else to have redemption, as long as you didn't have that kind of crime, or you didn't commit this kind of crime or that kind of crime. The church teaches, and Christ teaches, that everyone is eligible for redemption, that all we had to do was go to Him and confess their sins and stop sinning.
So this affected so many more relationships, because if you left that church, not only did it affect your entire family, now you're leaving a community that you've been a part of for, I'm assuming, a number of years.
Yes, for decades. It didn't take long, but I think that other people were also seeing some signs of problems within the church. And so I know several of those people that I've had connections with for decades left to go on to other churches as well. And it's been a struggle for me ever since to be able to find a church that actually practiced what it preaches. There are some that say, well, we're okay with people on the registry, but we don't want them to do this or we don't want that. And I can't stand for a church that wants to exclude people. Knowing what I've been through and seeing how the impact of all of this had on the families of the person who committed the harm, God really moved in my heart to reach out to those individuals and to help them, because in my own hurt, I needed to help them in their hurt as well.
So you went from being someone who was severely impacted in your family to being an advocate. And
absolutely,
you got really involved. So tell us a little bit about that journey. Like, how did that come about?
Well, dealing with the criminal justice system and the way that our family was treated horribly, being told that our voices were not important because we were not advocating for the harsh punishment, really pushed me into getting involved in pushing for reform, which led me to start working with Janice and Axel. Started going with her to the state capitol to start advocating for reform. I go to the capitol and share my story. But all the while also hearing the family members and the struggles that they were going through, hearing the parents and the fact that they can't talk to the friends and families, talking to the wives, and that they can't talk to people because they also feel the shame of what their loved one committed. They were feeling the same hurt I was feeling. And so I really had this heart to create a support group for those who were on the registry and for the loved ones who support them. That's been a long journey, trying to create a support group for those who are dealing with all of this and talking with multiple churches within my community and suggesting something like this, that, you know, we practice redemption is for everybody. We also should offer support. And what a better way to reach out to those who need Christ most, those who were rejected, as Christ reached out to those who rejected in his days. And I just kept getting the door slammed shut. Fortunately, God finally opened a door to a church who understands and who do believe in redemption for all. And when I asked, they said yes. And so I've actually have a support group that meets weekly, you know, at their church for individuals. Obviously with COVID right now, that's been more remote, but still I'm able to reach out and help so many people who
have you been able to keep that group together
this.
During the pandemic?
We're doing Zoom meetings so that we were talking and sharing with one another until a point that the church feels it's safe enough to resume meetings in person again. So I'm grateful that we have platforms like this, that we can be able to get together and talk and share and have others deal with what they're going through. I get healing by talking to those who have committed harm and finding out their whys and the things that they have done in order to prevent themselves from going down the wrong path. And I've heard so many of them tell me that they find healing because I can give them a voice that they haven't been able to get. I'm coming from the voice of a victim, secondary victim, but still a victim nonetheless, and that they can hear my side so that way I can offer healing. So in a way, we're doing a restorative justice circle.
So you started off where people in the neighborhood, you're terrified of the other, the guy that might come in that's been put on the registry. And now you're sitting down in meetings with people who have committed probably some pretty horrible acts, and you're finding their humanity and talking with them and getting to know them and healing and their healing and your healing. And that's the service you're bringing.
Oh, absolutely. I can be in a room full of people who are on the registry and feel like in a room full of family.
Wow, that's really powerful. Let's go back just a little bit and talk a little bit about the criminal justice system and how that process went from the side of somebody who had experienced harm and being the mother of somebody who had experienced harm. What was that process like for you?
More traumatic, I think. I know it was more traumatic for all of us than the initial abuse. When this went through, I really sat down with my daughter and really tried to get from her what it is that she wanted out of all of this. Because as her mother, I wanted to be her advocate. I wanted to make sure that she got the justice that she wanted. Her sense of justice was 1 year for every year that she was suffering abuse. So that was 4 years. However, the prosecutor didn't agree, didn't feel that that was harsh enough. And so the best offer that was ever offered to the person was 20 years with a maximum of 30 years. When I tried to tell them that that is not the justice that we were looking for, you know, and told them what she wanted, her response was, well, she's not old enough to know what she wants. Mind you, she is old enough to operate a motor vehicle. She is old enough to hold a job. She's old enough to babysit kids. She's old enough that if I was in a divorce, that she could choose which parent she wanted to live with. She's old enough that if she was criminally charged, she can be tried as an adult. Yet, she was not old enough to decide what is justice for her.
So you're saying you really didn't feel like the current justice system heard your voice and your daughter's voice?
No. In fact, they heard us more. They used CPS as an attack dog in order to get us into compliance, threatening to remove my kids from me because I was not protecting them, because I was advocating for a lighter punishment than they were looking for.
Wait. We got to stop there. So you were devastated that this was going on. You bring it forward. Somebody that you care about was criminally charged, put through this system. Somebody else that you care about was harmed, and they're threatening you for not taking care of your family, for not trying to be as punitive as possible.
Correct. To the point that I even had CPS looking into criminally charging me.
That's devastating.
And I was the one who reported the abuse, and they wanted to criminally charge me because I reported the abuse, because in their eyes, I must have known and I allowed it to happen. Therefore, I should be criminally charged. Luckily, I had people surrounding me and advocating that I'm a good mom, that I would do everything that I could to protect my kids. And that, thankfully, thank you God, that nothing ever came of that. But to the point that you would charge someone who reported abuse and took action immediately as soon as they found out. We're not talking about days or months or years. I'm talking about hours. Even to the point that I made sure that my kids were placed in a protective space so that way I can go and confront the person who committed the harm prior to calling the authorities. I took action immediately, yet I was looked at as being culpable.
It's insane.
Yeah.
Wow. So now you've been on this journey. You have experienced life a long way. I mean, we all are involved in advocacy, but, you know, every day we get up and we still have children and we have jobs and we have other stress makers, if you will, and we keep continuing on. What did everyday life look like for you after this process occurred for you, your family, your daughter?
Taking everything a day at a time, a step at a time, was a challenge. It took a good 2 years to finally get to a point where I wasn't trying to remind myself to breathe. And it still have been years after that, just dealing with the emotional impact that all of this has had. But it's also caused a desire to want to do change. The thing I like to say the most is that, if anything, the justice system pissed off the wrong person. And that in order for my healing to occur, I had to do something to create change, which is why I dove into advocacy. I had to do something. They pissed off the wrong person, and I have to do something about this because I seen injustice and I can't allow it to continue. And I think that that has really helped a lot with my healing by being involved in reform. It definitely helped out a lot over the years until the last year or so, where I've been able to start the emotional support group to offer that help. I went through counseling for those 2 years just to deal with A, the initial shock, and then B, another year just dealing with the emotional turmoil of going through trial and the way that the prosecutor treated all of us in order to get the conviction that they were looking for.
Well, one of the things that you said I really connected with when you said that folks who are associated with someone who's committed harm, you know, maybe their wives or things like that, are feeling the same feelings. So, you know, that really brings to mind for me that idea of shame. So when we talk about sexual violence and sexual harm, that brings a lot of shame to everyone involved in that. And the registry and, you know, the regime that kind of surrounds all of the restrictions on the registry and whatnot cause a lot of shame to families. And I know that because you do so much work with families, you kind of see that in your interactions. Let's talk a little bit more about that. What are some of the things when you work with families that you see some of those parallels?
Well, again, the shame is the primary thing that I see. They can't talk to people about it because people see them as enablers, that if they're supporting the person who committed harm, then they must have been okay with the harm that was committed, which is not true. Just like I was being seen as that, well, I must have seen the abuse and I allowed it to happen. And all the people that I know who have someone who's on the registry, none of them ever agreed to what happened was okay. None of them believe that what the person did didn't cause harm. They all know that. What they believe in and what I believe in is that people are able to change, and that when we give them the opportunity and the permission to change, and I think that's the biggest thing, is that we have to allow them the permission that they can change. We can't keep telling them, well, no, you can't change because you committed this heinous offense. They can. We know that they can because the data shows that they can. We know that the reoffense rate is one among the lowest among all other crimes. So the data is there. We know that that happens. I see it. I've talked to men who've been outside offense-free for decades after they committed harm. I know that they also are feeling the wounds of the offense. Again, I call myself a secondary victim. The family members of the person who committed harm, they're also secondary victims. Whether they knew the person at the time that the offense was committed or even after the offense was committed, they still feel the wounds of the offense because of the way society treats them. You know, same reason why victims, they feel shame and when they come out and talk about their abuse and people shame them and blame them. Well, you must have done something to lead the person on or whatever they use. we're all in the same boat. We all feel that same emotion. We all feel that shame in one way or another. We can't talk about it. You can't talk to other people about what you're going through unless they know what you're going through. Family members can't talk to other people about dealing with the effects of the registry because they don't understand what it's like.
You talk about the emotional support groups that you're part of, and that's wonderful. And that's for family members like you. There's an opportunity if people can get over that shame hurdle and go and seek it out. They can find those emotional support groups. What's really tough is that people who have committed harm, oftentimes the only groups that are available to them are mandated groups that are part of supervision, and they're not allowed to associate with people who have also committed harm till years later. You know, so that healing is often delayed. That can be a challenge.
And luckily, in the county that I live in, the mandated treatment provider that the men in my group go to, when the men have told them what the support group is about and where it's located, they were given permission to attend. So even though they are still on supervised release, their treatment provider gave them the okay. In fact, they actually encourage it.
So can you talk a little bit about what the process, did you, as the person who is organizing the group, did you do some work to talk to probation and parole? What was that process, or is that individual to individual for that permission?
This is just individual to individual. Whenever I have someone who is interested in attending and say that they're on supervised release, I tell them that they'll first need to talk to their probation or parole officer and talk to their mandated treatment provider to get prior approval. And I offer them to have those individuals contact me if they have any questions, but I haven't had anybody ever contact me. In fact, they've just said, okay, no problem, and just allowed them to attend.
Yeah, we need to create a blueprint across the country so that that's available everywhere.
Yeah. I think it definitely helps the fact that the group is at a church so that they feel like there's a organization behind it. It's not just an individual group just by other people. I think that that gives it more credibility for those probation and parole officers and treatment providers versus if it was just a in-home support group that they're a little, maybe a little more cautious of.
Thank you. I want to take it in a little different direction. When the abuse first became public knowledge, were there people in your circle that surprised you either because they didn't offer you the support you were looking for, they didn't want to hear about what you needed, or may have surprised you in another way, somebody who may have been not such a close friend who really came forward and gave you the support that you needed?
Yeah, I lost friends when they found out that we were actually supportive of the person who committed harm and supporting their rehabilitation, and we did not want the harsh punishment. It actually fractured my family to the point that I had to cut off family members because they were causing so much more stress and emotional trauma that I almost had a mental breakdown because I just could not handle another aspect of them attacking me because I was not being harsh enough in regards to what punishment that person should get. On the flip side, I've had people who I thought were going to be totally judgmental or not wanting what I wanted or what my daughter wanted, who were supportive. In fact, some of them were even victims themselves. That shocked me.
I think that's very common. You know, once you become a magnet for so many stories, I mean, that can also become overwhelming, right? People come out of the woodwork and share with you, this happened in my family, this happened to me, this happened, you know. So did you experience any of that?
I feel the more people who come and talk to me and share their stories with me, it's more healing because we're connecting in
Amber
a way that no one else.
I'm shaking
no
my
one
head.
Else.
You can't see, but I am definitely shaking my head in agreement.
you know, every time you talk to somebody who understands what you're going through, the more healing you get, and you don't realize that they're still hurt. You know, I've been dealing with this for 8 years, and I'm still today, every time I talk to someone new, I get another piece of healing that I didn't know that I still needed. And I think that this is going to be an evolution. I think there will always be a small piece of healing that will always need to be done. And just talking and connecting with other people who are experiencing the effects of sexual harm, regardless if they're the person who committed the harm, or if they're the family member, or they're the victim, we're all dealing with the same things, and we're all trying to connect with one another because we all feel the exact same emotions.
Right. You realize you're not alone, and it helps lessen that shame that can build up and be so devastating.
Yeah. We're all looking for the same thing. We're all looking to heal the harm and the hurt that was caused.
So what do you feel is the path forward on a personal level and on a policy level? I guess that's two questions.
On a personal level, I would say restorative justice. Restorative justice brings about the healing that everybody needs and wants. Prison sentences doesn't help neither the victim nor the person who committed the harm. Whereas a restorative justice, where the person sits down with the other person, regardless if it's direct or if it's someone who is of a like mind, similar offense, you're able to connect with one another and share and talk to each other and create the healing that needs to be done. The victim can see the person having true remorse and taking accountability for their actions, taking ownership, seeing the fact that what they're doing in order to help themselves so that way they do not cause harm to someone else, which is so important to those who experience sexual harm. So it's definitely a better platform in dealing with that. There might be some where a prison sentence may be appropriate, but for the most part, I do believe restorative justice is the better option.
So what do you say to those folks who are skeptical of restorative justice practices, who say we're just all hugging and making up and the accountability isn't there?
No, there absolutely is accountability. In fact, you know, I talk with Dr. Alyssa Ackerman, and she does these a lot, and she actually makes sure that the person who committed the harm actually does something to show accountability. There is something that they have to do. Sometimes, yes, there is an appropriate sentence, which is a prison. Like I said, for us, it was acceptable for this person to go to prison for 4 years. That was an appropriate sentence. 30 years was definitely not appropriate, but we could also have a restorative justice circle in order to help heal those wounds for both sides.
I want to make sure that Jean has an opportunity to tell whatever part of her story, whatever part of your story, Jean, that you want to tell that you really just never have an opportunity to talk about.
And my thing right now is that I really would love for the churches to start working proactively and educating their parishioners, congregants on sexual violence. What does it look like? What are preventative measures? As well as offering help and support for those who have committed sexual harm. We know just by looking at media that the church has been horrible in dealing with sexual harm. They need to do a better job. They need to do a better job in educating people on what the warning signs and ways that they can help prevent it. And they're doing a horrible job in regards to putting protections in place for those who are dealing with those who are at risk of sexual harm. And I would also say that they need to do a better job reaching out and helping the people who are indirectly affected, the family members, who have the loved one who committed the harm, as well as the families who have experienced the sexual harm. They need to do a better job in helping with facilitate the healing instead of ignoring it. And the church has been really good about ignoring it, and they need to stop doing that.
And so do you see yourself and organizations that you're involved in as a resource for those churches or people affiliated with religious organizations who really want that for themselves?
I would love to be that resource. I just don't know if I have the professional experience to be able to be that, but definitely someone with a personal experience. I am really hoping that the group that I have is a good pathway for other churches to see that you can have something like this in effect and it not causing any harm to anybody. There's no collateral consequences as a result. None of the people in the groups that have attended have reoffended, so that they can see that there's actually a success in this. And it's not just people talking around, talking about their feelings. We're actually developing curriculum as we go along. There's actually discussions going on. We have it similar set up like a Celebrate Recovery, where we actually have topics that we talk about every single week. And like I said, it is definitely something similar to like a restorative justice, where both sides can talk about the hurts that they've experienced and the healing that they're going through.
That's good. Very good.
Jean, I really can't thank you enough for talking with us today and the amazing work that you're doing. Your voice is so important. And I think that your life experience really adds to the conversation. A lot of times people think that there's us, there's them, there's victims, there's perpetrators. But one of the big things that we're trying to do with this work, and it seems you're trying to do as well, is really bring the humanity and that shared humanity that all of us have together in order to move things forward. Because at the end of the day, it's all about restoring people to community and allowing for that healing. So I'm just so thrilled to have you here today and have you share your experiences.
Well, I appreciate you guys so much for just allowing me to be able to share this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Amplified Voices, a podcast lifting the experiences of people and families impacted by the criminal legal system. For more information, episodes, and podcast notes, visit amplifiedvoices.show.